This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
I'm Mike Finnerty, and you're listening to Quebec This Week, a program featuring some of the stories that matter most to people in Quebec. The Parti Québécois tabled its Quebec identity bill last week, and it's been causing a stir ever since. Party leader Pauline Marois says it would foster Quebec citizenship, but others are saying it fosters discrimination. Prominent PQ MNA Bernard Drinville will talk to us about the bill in a moment. We'll also hear from the head of the Centre for Action on race relations. He'll tell us why he thinks the bill constitutes a serious infringement of democratic rights. And on a completely different topic, we'll meet a journalist and author who's traveled the world to report on wars and AIDS, and she's just received a nomination for a Governor General's Award for her latest book. First, Bernard Drinville, PQ MNA for Marie-Victorin on Montreal's South Shore. Bernard Drinville, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Here's the thing that I'd like you to help me understand about the Parti Québécois identity bill that was tabled in the National Assembly last week. Now, the whole reasonable accommodation debate, it's difficult to know where and when it actually took off. There was the whole controversy over the tainted windows at the Park Avenue Y, the Kirpan, the Declaration of Rights and Norms in Hérouville, wherever. But the thing is, it was not sparked by French or the quality of French spoken by New Quebecers. And so what I'm trying to understand is why the identity bill that your party's put forward proposes a French test for new Quebecers to achieve Quebec citizenship.
Yeah, the overall principle of the whole package is to strengthen the status of the French language in order for the French language to act as a facilitator of integration.
But it wasn't wasn't the French language that was at the heart of people being upset that, for instance, some Jewish men didn't want to have female driving instructors or didn't want female caregivers or, it wasn't about French. It was about religious accommodation in many ways. And yet here it is turned into something about French.
Well, you're right, but partly. But Mike, first, we think that, for example, Bill 101, by asking the children of immigrants to go to the French-speaking school, the French school, we think that by going to the French school, they better understand, they acquire a sense of what the Quebec identity and Quebec values are about. I think by acquiring the French language, they acquire the tools to better integrate themselves.
But that's working, isn't it?
So if you want to talk about religious issues and cultural issues, I think one way of addressing them is by giving the immigrants a sense of the kind of culture and society they've arrived in.
Don't you think that's working? The idea that new Quebecers are going to French school. Look, I was away from Quebec for 10 years. I used to live here. I came back. And I go to the YMCA at Guy Favreau, which is in Chinatown. The first thing you notice that's different from 10 years ago is that all the Chinese origin Québécois who go there now speak to each other in Québécois. So isn't that working?
Good.
Haven't
that's working.
You done what you wanted to do?
This is working. But we need to do more now with the immigrants. The men and women you're talking to me about are those who we call the sons of Bill 101. But what we need now, we're going to increase the level of immigration in Quebec. And the PQ, we support it. Now, when they come to Quebec, we think they should learn French, and we're going to help them learning French.
But they
and
are
this
learning
is the overall
French,
package.
Okay.
Well,
and
no.
Why do you now
got 20,000 out of 50,000 immigrants who come to Quebec over the past 10 years didn't know the French language when they arrived, and we think that by helping them,
by the time they go to French school, it all works out, doesn't it?
Well, no, it's not working. We think they should be offered French classes as soon as they arrived in Quebec in order for them to get a job as quickly as possible. Well, because we realized that people who are coming here, they want to work.
But what they tell us and what it seems like they're telling pollsters too, I know that your proposal's got a lot of support amongst Francophone Quebecers, but not so much with new Quebecers. Yes. And I think what people are resisting is... It seems like a second tier of citizenship because they will already have their Canadian citizenship. So they already have citizenship. Mm. But you're saying that in order to act in a political way, to run for office or to fund political parties, they need to get a second one and to pass a French test. But why not just give them classes?
They need to learn French in order to get that Quebec citizenship. Why is it unreasonable for Canada to ask its candidates for citizenship to master either French or English, and wouldn't it be reasonable for Quebec to do the same?
Right. Here's why. Here's the argument. It's that having already got your Canadian citizenship, there's now you're suggesting a second citizenship, which would then create a second tier. So you could be a citizen, but not a Quebec citizen. So you're making a whole second class of citizens.
You're telling me that the French classes and integration into the French society is working.
You agreed.
You're telling me about all of these sons of immigrants who are speaking French
but
today.
We're saying
that you would need to be French speaking, and we're not talking about someone who speaks Molière. You know, we're talking about someone who have a reasonable, sufficient, basic knowledge of French to show that it does have this basic knowledge of French in order to acquire the Quebec citizenship and be able to run for office. We think this is a perfectly reasonable proposal.
Tell me, how irritating is it for you as a party to have Bernard Landry come out of the woodwork suddenly and say, Pauline Marois is a smart woman, but there are problems with this proposal?
Well, we got free speech in this society, and you know, the Parti Québécois is a party of debate. It's always been a party of debate, and we're going to have to live with that. And it's not such a big problem. I mean, sometimes it is a bit irritating, but in this case, he just, you know, he added his voice to the debate, and Madame Marois said, you know, she respects his opinion, and you know, she agrees that he's got a right to voice his opinion. Now, Madame Marois didn't say her package was a take it or leave it kind of package. She said, I want to debate it and I'm open-minded about changes and amendments that could be made to it. So let's debate it. Monsieur Landry has made a few points. We've listened to it. But hopefully the ADQ and the Liberal Party will want to debate with us. Obviously, you've made a reference to that. The Quebec population, we have a certain level of support, in spite of the fact that all the columnists came out against this proposal very, very strongly.
Aren't you worried when looking at that poll numbers to see that this policy is dividing Quebec again?
Look, I mean, we've tabled a proposal exactly 1 week ago, last Thursday. And you've got, 70 or 75% of Quebecers saying that they heard about it and they have a certain knowledge about it. I think the debate is only starting. As Quebecers know more and more about the proposal, as they see its value, let's talk about all of these other very generous measures we're going to put forward to help immigrants learning the language of the majority in Quebec and helping them through it, finding a job and being more happy, you know, being comfortable in this new society of theirs.
Bernard Granville, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us, for coming into the studio in Quebec City. Really appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Anytime.
I'm Mike Finnerty, and you're listening to Quebec This Week. Well, now that we've heard from PQ-MNA Bernard Drainville on this bill, let's listen to what the executive director of the Centre for Action on Race Relations has to say about it.
Good afternoon, Foniemi.
Good afternoon.
Now, your news releases and your news conference criticized the bill on a couple of levels. Why do you think that this bill is unconstitutional? Let's start with that.
Well, first of all, it deals with citizenship. It gives the Attorney General, the Minister of Justice, the power to decide on so-called future Quebec citizenship. As you know, in this country, there's only one citizenship, and that's Canadian citizenship. It's a federal power and it's a federal authority. So right there, it's ultra-virus in the sense it's out of the Quebec jurisdiction.
So
right, it's unconstitutional. The other aspects of unconstitutionality are related to the numerous violation or restriction of fundamental human rights and freedoms in this bill proposed to enact.
So to clarify, what do you mean by restrictions on rights of citizens?
Well, for example, the bill specifically mentioned that in the new Quebec citizenship framework, only Quebec citizens will have the right to petition the legislature for redress of grievance. The Quebec Charter of Human Rights and Freedom, which is provincial legislation right now, guaranteed a right to petition the government to every person in Quebec. So right there, that's a restriction based on citizenship status. And that's discrimination. And so that's one part. And the other one, it says only Quebec citizens can make financial contributions to political parties. And that's another restriction because permanent residents should be able to make funding contribution to political parties.
And what do you think of the idea that this thing has even happened, that this bill has even been tabled? I mean, what does that indicate to you?
Well, it says a couple of things. That honestly, the political, moral, and social values of in Quebec here have to be recalibrated and redefined and refocused because we seem to be drifting towards a direction that we don't want to go, i.e., the one of intolerance and xenophobia. And secondly, for this kind of concept to be put in a bill to be introduced by a political party that has on numerous occasions governed the province of Quebec, it's completely unthinkable that that can happen, because this bill legalizes, in our opinion, discrimination against certain classes of people because of who they are. And it squarely, you know, it's not only against the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, but it's against a host of international conventions and instruments on civil, political, and minority rights that are before the United Nations.
And what about the idea that this is sort of like the nationalism through the back door, that a lot of French-speaking Quebecers are sympathetic to the intentions of this bill? What would you say to those people?
Well, unfortunately, we must say the most public discussion so far focused on the part dealing with the French language training of immigrants and the so-called Francization programs. But if more Quebecers are aware of the fact that this bill takes away fundamental democratic rights of people that are already guaranteed in the present laws, and certainly they'll recoil, because we believe that the vast majority of Quebecers are have a lot of common sense, are reasonable, are progressive, are fair-minded, and they have not read the bill. And, you know, the bill is formulated in such a way that even children born overseas and adopted by Quebec parents and families will also be affected adversely by this kind of restriction and discrimination.
And what about those people who are on the language question, which I think you're right in saying has become the primary focus of this? There are people who say, well, you know, immigrants and new Quebecers should just learn French. And if they can't learn French, they can't live in Quebec.
Well, of course, everybody wants to learn French because, I mean, just for purely functional purposes, you need to speak the language of where you live. There are people, however, who will have problems learning French because of age, senior citizens who come here because of family unification. There are people who, because of work and other economic conditions, their learning French will be slowed down. There are all kinds of questions that we need to take into consideration, so that whatever that we want to achieve through legislation or through public policy, it has to be done in a way that it is based on common sense, fairness, and the principle which is most fundamental to any modern democracy is one of respect for human rights and minority rights. And that's the problem with the whole debate right now on Quebec identity or about the bills that are before the Quebec legislature, that the protection of minority rights is not even considered as a fundamental value of Quebec. And we think it's about time that all political parties reaffirm that fundamental value.
Do you think it's a little bit ironic that Quebecers who view themselves as a minority aren't showing, or some Quebecers are showing themselves not to be particularly sensitive to the idea of minority rights for others?
It is ironic, but, you know, it's not only to Quebec, because there's a wind of intolerance sweeping through many Western democracies that lend credence to the notion of a class of civilization, particularly in Europe, because of the fact that we as a society, as a country, are receiving more and more immigrants from countries that are not producing what we call, white immigrants or Christian immigrants. So there's a lot of resistance, there's a lot of rising intolerance and discomfort about these new phases of immigration. And so that's why we have to be not only vigilant, but we have to be really, shall we say, forward-looking, because that's the way of the world, and we have to find ways but to restrict, to discriminate, and to marginalize, and to exclude people on these lines in terms of culture, ethnicity, and religion is definitely not the way to go, because that's really against everything that we as the world through the United Nations have done since the end of the Second War with the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
And UN Day was yesterday. Well, thank you very much for talking to us today, Fonny Ami.
Well, thank you.
Au revoir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm Mike Finnerty, and you're listening to Quebec This Week. Stephanie Nolan is a journalist and author who loves to travel the world after the big story. She's covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for the Globe and Mail, and then asked to be sent to Africa. Let's listen to the conversation she had earlier this week with the CBC's Dave Bronstetter.
Stephanie Nolan is a Montrealer who has traveled the world. Her latest book, 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa, has been nominated for a Governor General's Award. And I spoke to Stephanie Nolan. She was on the line from Johannesburg. Stephanie Nolan, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You covered the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq for the Globe, and then you asked to be assigned to Africa. Why'd you do that?
Well, the time that I was spending in Iraq and Afghanistan, they were big stories. And you could tell because I was surrounded by literally thousands of other members of the International Press Corps. But when I wasn't doing those, I would go and travel in Africa, and it quickly became clear to me that the stories that I was covering here, and in particular what I was seeing of the impact of HIV on communities across Africa, were in fact much bigger stories than anything that was happening in Afghanistan or Iraq. And yet I would travel here, and I would be the only Western reporter. I mean, I wouldn't see another one for 3 or 4 months at a time. And so I tried to persuade the Globe that we were missing a really big story.
And did they have initially that sense of the big stories are elsewhere?
I think because I had the sense as a journalist that I was missing something. So the deal I sort of made with the Globe was that I would do the big war zones if I also got to do some of the stuff that I wanted to do. And I had come to Africa for the first time in 1998. And reported on the tide of refugees coming out of the Democratic Republic of Congo into Tanzania, and spent a little bit of time in the Congo. And I remember very clearly standing in this vast plain in western Tanzania and seeing just as far as my eye could see, seeing these people in these little makeshift houses. So many people. I mean, I just couldn't even begin to fathom how many people that was, and thinking, wait a second, I haven't seen this on TV. I haven't seen this in the paper. Where is this story? So that was the first time, and then on every subsequent trip to Africa, I got more and more convinced that there were epic stories happening here, but that I just wasn't hearing about them in the news at home. And, you know, for a reporter, I mean, it's a bit cold, but it's true. The gratification comes on being on the big story. And sometimes you get the sense it's the big story, like when you're in Iraq and you're surrounded by the bright lights and the women with the blow-dried hair on the, you know, doing the CNN live shot. But sometimes you also know it's a big story, even if there is no satellite truck, just because of the scale of what you're reporting on. And I felt like this was where the biggest stories were, and it was where I wanted to be.
Yeah. I understand what drives you as a reporter, but, I mean, was there something compelling else about Africa?
You know, actually, Dave, I try and avoid, I think we still have this terrible tendency to talk about, to romanticize Africa, to exoticize it. And people are forever saying to me, or people saying, you know, oh, she fell in love with Africa. Well, Africa's 59 countries, and I've been to a lot of them and had a pretty bad time in a lot of them. You know, there's 700 million people in sub-Saharan Africa, and some of them are lovely and some of them not so much. When people say, but don't you love the people? Well, no, I don't love the people. I like some people here. but I try and avoid this whole idea of kind of, you know, a sort of African queen kind of falling in love with the people sort of, you know, I had a farm in Africa kind of breathlessness that we still so often talk about Africa with.
Yeah, the flame trees of Theca kind of thing, that condescending romanticism.
Yeah, I mean, I should go and get myself some crumpled white linen clothing, I guess. A lot of gin and tonic on the front veranda.
Yeah, get your hair done a lot more like the CNN reporters.
Yeah, which actually would not necessarily be a bad idea, but it's a persistent argument with my hairdresser because like I spend so much time at the hairdresser. On my annual visit to the hairdresser, they always want to do something kind of exciting. And I always say, but I spend most of my time in places without electricity and quite often any running water. So please just take that into account, which I guess limits your options as an artist.
Then taking aside that Western penchant for asking that question, I would like to know some preconceived notions you had and then the impressions you got. I mean, you gave us a beautiful one a few minutes ago. Are there any others where you had your preconceived Western notions and they were either shattered or what?
Oh, boy. You know, I think certainly around the idea of HIV, I had this perception, and it was born from the kinds of things that I saw on my first few trips, of just disaster, of just people dying, and just the misery, the conventional picture, you know, the gaunt sort of stick thin person, fly settling into the open lesions on their face kind of thing. And yes, there was lots of that, but very quickly, when I started to actually live here, I came to realize that there was this extraordinary activist community, and that some of their focus, sure, was about trying to get more money from donor countries to get more attention from the international community, but that most of their energy was in fact designed or aimed at designing and mounting some kind of response to the pandemic in their own communities, and that most of the help for AIDS in Africa was not coming from outside, but was coming from right within the countries and the communities where it was happening, and it was the poorest, most marginalized, sickest people who were doing the most to respond to the pandemic, and whether it was activists who were taking on you know, women who'd been infected through sexual violence who were taking on men in their communities, or women, you know, in South Africa, the great campaign both against drug companies and against the government has been mounted largely by women who are, frankly, semi-literate sort of peasants. You know, they're subsistence farmers from rural areas with limited education, and they have united around trying to get access to drugs. And they have this incredibly sophisticated understanding of the pharmacology of these drugs, the debates that go into how they're priced, the whole issue of patents and compulsory licenses. So I was as guilty, I think, as anyone else in the West may have been, of just conceiving this as a very one-dimensional story full of victims. And in fact, there were very few victims.
When did it become personal?
You know, I don't think there was a moment. I think there was a gradual process. I think the first few times that I traveled in really badly hit countries and saw all of these incredibly sick people and there was no one doing anything, I would go back to my posh, overpriced hotel at night and think, where the hell is everybody? It sort of got to the point where I started to wonder, was I kind of crazy? Because was I seeing something that other people weren't seeing? Or was I just wrong? Was I wrong about the scale of it? Was I deluded? And so then I started to be started to be both angry and a person. I think it became fairly unpleasant to spend time around me. I became a sort of hectoring harridan. And then it just got closer and closer to me. I came to care about a lot of these people that I was interviewing often, and they would die. When one of my closest friends here in Johannesburg, a fellow named Tokozani, came to tell me that he was infected, then it was right there at my kitchen table. But I think you can't live in the middle of it. You know, I live in a city where one in three people has HIV, and you can't live in the middle of that and not have it be profoundly personal.
What's everyday like in Joburg?
Oh, Joburg is a weird, weird place. It's the city of trees, they like to tell you, supposedly more trees than any other city in the world. But it's really a city of walls and gates, and you can spend your whole life, and many white South Africans do, in the northern suburbs, as they're called, traveling from one gated compound to another, and almost never interacting with the city. And then you can go downtown, and there's the remains of the wealthy city that the white apartheid era built, but a sort of African city has seeped up through the cracks downtown. So there's street side, you know, sidewalk barber stalls and women selling heaps of mangoes and immigrants from all over Africa. Was possibly one of the most wonderful things about downtown is that everybody across Africa who wants to make a buck or cut a record or launch a fashion line moves to Joburg. And so there's this really diverse Pan-African community downtown. And there are these staggering disparities in wealth. I mean, there are blind Zimbabweans, disabled Zimbabweans from who've come in as illegal refugees begging on almost every street corner these days. And at the same time, there are more. I was noticing this morning at the grocery store that mine was the only car in the parking lot that was not either a Mercedes or a BMW. So it's very weird in that sense. And it's both a place still savoring its freedom, which is lovely to see, and also still profoundly racist, which for me as a Canadian is a little bit hard to get used to.
Well, yeah, but it's interesting. You managed to find happy moments in this as well, because, I mean, the story, especially about AIDS in Africa and society changing in South Africa, is a heavy story. But you found lots of almost euphoric moments.
You know, I think what maybe imbues things with that quality here is the stakes at which people, the issues that they're fighting for, the sort of the level of risk, the level of danger that people are, you know, those activists, the rural women I was talking about a few minutes ago, are fighting literally for their own lives and for the lives and survival of their communities. And so when people live on that kind of a scale, I think it just it injects both the bad parts with a terrible tragedy and also the happy moments with the euphoria. And the story of AIDS in Africa is not a story, believe it or not, of unmitigated gloom. I mean, there have been incredible victories here, and societies have changed profoundly because of the virus, mostly in ways that are good, with greater openness and greater equality for women and greater frankness around sex. And it's greater challenges to leadership, greater organization around access to resources and disparities in wealth. And so it's an incredible privilege to have a sort of ringside seat on this. It would be hard at this point to live anywhere else.
Is it home, though?
No, it isn't home. Montreal is home, and I am, even hearing your accent, I'm homesick.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to make you sad.
Oh, that's okay. I have a couple of carefully rationed jars of maple syrup and a couple of boxes of Kraft Dinner in the cupboard, and they get me through.
Stephanie, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
And you, thanks very much for calling.
Take care. Come home soon sometime.
Thanks very much.
Bye. Globe and Mail reporter Stephanie Nolan's latest book, 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa, has been nominated for a Governor General's Award.
I'm Mike Finnerty, and you've been listening to Quebec This Week from CBC Radio. It's a program available only online at cbc.ca/podcasting. If you'd like to comment on anything you've just heard, contact us by going to cbc.ca and clicking on the Contact Us link. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.